Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Gwyn Scheltema, my co-host Felicity Signal-Reed, and our guest this week, Daryl Sneath. Daryl, that was a lovely reading. I especially liked the setting references and because I'm a sucker for landscape, but it was very beautiful. Thank you very much. Now, every writer has their own process, so how do you begin a book? Do you start with an incident and a plot or a group of characters?
Well, I haven't attempted the long project very many times, but the number of times that I have, it's been different every time. And with all my sins, it started with an incident and a topic and the notion that I wanted to write something non-sentimental and narratively driven, because that was those were the two pieces of criticism I had been given on a previous manuscript that didn't make it very far.
Okay. Now, this is an interesting format, this novel. It's not the straightforward, you know, chapter one, chapter two, and all narrative. Like, if you flip through the book, there's pieces of script in there, play script, and the whole book, in a way, is a letter. And there are footnotes, too, which is unusual for a novel. So what did you do with the structure of this book? What were you trying out?
When I set up to write the thing, I'm a big fan of Hamlet, and the protagonist is an English teacher, and so I made him a fan of Hamlet. The first formal thing was to set it in five parts and try and work through a Shakespearean type of narrative, although I don't think it qualifies as either comedy or tragedy, and certainly not history. But it has five parts, and each of the five parts takes the title from a quotation from Hamlet. So that's the first part of the form. You had mentioned the letter. Ostensibly, the novel's a letter to a woman that Ben Dunn fell in love with. Her name was Ashlyn Byrne when he was younger, and it's sort of an apologetic letter, but he realizes fairly early on that 20 pages in, he hasn't even apologized yet, and it's getting far too long for a letter. So it sets up ostensibly as a letter, but it's sort of tongue-in-cheek as a letter. Mm-hmm. The footnotes do one of two things. One, it allows Ben to speak directly to Ashlyn, as though he were still writing the letter to her, hoping that she might pick this up one day in a used bookstore. And two, it's a nod to Mordecai Richler, because in part I took the antagonist, the inspiration at least, from Barney's version, my favorite Richler novel by far. And in that novel, the main character's son edits the final product and makes footnotes. So those footnotes are in part an homage to Richler as well.
Well, a nice, interesting way of doing things. Now, I had mentioned that the pieces I liked in your reading are sort of atmospheric bits. So how important is place and setting to you when you write?
I think that in any narrative, place is as much a character probably as any of the characters in the novel itself. I'm reading a novel right now by Ali Smith, How to Be Both, and it's split in two. The first part is set in 1490, I think, in Italy, and the second part is modern-day Ireland, I believe. And although those characters could flip between 1490 and today, because of the time and because of the place, they are certainly shaped in certain ways that are inevitable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have a rural setting, then your characters are going to be informed by that, the rural nature of where they live and how they live.
And is the rural setting an Ontario rural setting?
Yes, a fictionalized one, for sure, right. But Heron River is a fictionalized version of Port Perry, Terry, which is where I teach, and Ben Dunn's hometown is Casterville, which is a sort of fun way of writing Beaverton in Latin, so yes, it's fictionalized.
And what are you writing now?
Now I'm working on a long project with a working title called Nothing But, and it is a sort of courtroom drama, I guess. Spent 3 months on a jury, so I'm trying to make use of that experience. It was very interesting and not at all what I thought it would be like, and it has given me a lot of fodder to work with, so I'm working through a story based on that.
So are you writing about that particular trial?
Not at all. No, it's one of the last things the judge said to us was something like, don't speak of this, and if you do, you could be charged.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not quite as heavy-handed as that, but yeah, no, it certainly wouldn't be anything at all to do with the trial that I was involved with.
Hmm. Well, I'd love to hear you read again.
Certainly.
Are you going to read some more from the book, or do you have something else?
I had something else from the book, but I also have the beginnings of two others that are very short, and I thought I might do that, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the first one here is the novel, or the manuscript. It's not a novel yet. It's called Steel Blue. Just very quickly, it's about a guy named Vector Sorn, and he's a running prodigy and a bit of an intellectual prodigy as well. He's witnessed something tragic in the beginning of the novel, and he spends the rest of the time working through that.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Sure.
So this is not the novel you're working on now.
No.
So you do have other novels around?
I have manuscripts around, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I have two more manuscripts that are finished and sitting on desks out there.
Okay, well.
Waiting to hear.
Hopefully you will hear soon.
Thank you very much. So this is the beginning of Steel Blue. If only he'd said no. If only he'd suggested waiting or made some joke about her insatiable appetite, which he could do without being offensive. He had a way of making everything he said to her sound like love, because it was. If only he'd scanned the subway station like he was trained to do. If only he'd seen the pusher standing like a specter by the column of Osiris. The disheveled hair, the glassy eyes, the saliva pooled at the corners of his mouth, the wicked grin, the fingernails bitten to the quick, the ratty woolen sweater hanging off him in the swelter of summer, the beltless, blood-stained, knee-torn pants, the bare feet, 6 strides away, zeroed in, the instinct to kill, the hate in his eyes, the underworldness of him. There were so many signs, and he saw none. That's what would do him in, knowing that he could have prevented it, knowing with tortured certainty that it wasn't inevitable, or, as the pundits of death say, her time. Because it wasn't, because how could it be? I can only guess how he felt. For a year I witnessed the unraveling. Regardless of how close you are to someone, what you are witness to, you never really know how another person feels. Feeling, I've come to learn, is not about knowing. I have no defense for what he did, nor do I have any judgment. I've never understood the point of judgment, and even if I did, what right would I have now? I stood beside the pusher like we were together waiting for the train. I stood there and did nothing. I watched her get to her knees, like some final parody of prayer. Our eyes met the moment before impact. She smiled. She smiled at me to say everything would be okay, when I knew there was no way in hell that it would. She was there, and then she was not. All I can see is her smiling. All I can hear is the screeching of the train. I didn't reach for her. There was time for her to get to her knees and smile at me, and I didn't even reach for her. How I didn't automatically drop to my stomach and stretch a hand towards her, I'll never know. How can I not have tried? If I were forced to make some sort of reflective self-assessment, I'd have to admit that I'm the kind of man whose instincts tell him to step away from the edge of the broken ice when someone ahead of him falls through. The kind of man to watch, dumbfounded and useless, as the current pulls the fallen under. It's what I did. I actually stepped away. How can that be anyone's instinct? To step away from the person who loves you most the moment she needs you. The moment she needs you to step forward, despite all your fear, despite whatever else that's in you, to cause delay and reach out your hand. How difficult it is when it matters most to reach out a hand. She smiled. She smiled at me and I stepped away. I don't know why we do what we do, but we do. It's a little heavier, that one.
It is.
And the last little bit I'm going to read is just a page long here. It's from the beginning of a manuscript that's called Before the Snow Flew, and I'll just read it. There's this dream I've been having for as long as I can remember about a horse falling through the roof of a root cellar. The ground beneath the animal gives way without warning. The earth crumbles. There's an audible snap of bone, a great whinnying cry. One of the animal's front legs is broken. I catch a glimpse of blood and bone. Despite the pain and debilitation, the horse tries to right itself, tries to climb free, but the more it struggles, the more it falters, the more it seems to sink, as though the earth is suddenly molten, as though a great Hadean beast suddenly opens its mouth, rolls its giant chthonic jaw, and masticates the mare alive. I'm 10. There's nothing I can do to help. I stand there with my fly rod and creel ready for the river and watch. I hear a screen door creak open and snap shut. From the porch of the nearby log home comes a man I recognize only from the dream. I seem to know him and feel safe when I see him coming unhurried towards me. It's difficult to tell his age. He has the look of the world around him. Sylvan. Eyes blue as stone, hair and beard like ash, skin like wood, as though stained by the womb of the earth that bore him. A cigarette hangs from his lips. Slung over his shoulder is a rifle. His hands are buried deep within the pockets of his coat. When he finally reaches me, he looks up, draws on the cigarette, exhales, and flicks the still-burning butt away, which sets the bush around us aflame. He sniffs, but it's me who smells the distinct mephitic stench of burning flesh. In sleep, there's no mistaking it. In life, I wouldn't know it. Unbothered, it seems, by the hellishness of it all, The man folds his arms, takes in the still struggling mare drowning in the rubble of the collapsed cellar, and in his cavernously deep measured voice says without looking at me, "Seems like the whole world is caving in."
Oh my.
Thank you.
Well, I certainly would want to keep reading and find out what that one was all about.
Well, thank you very much.
Anyway, thanks very much for joining us today and for reading.
Thanks very much for having me here today. I've had a lot of fun. Thanks again.
Where can listeners buy your book or contact you? Or
I have a webpage that I don't really update very often, but it's out there in the world of the internet. My email is on there.
So what is your website?
It's my name, DarylSneath.com.
And Daryl is with one R, Y-L.
One of everything, yeah. DarylSneath.
Perfect. And if listeners would like to connect with us, send comments, queries, or suggestions, please email us at wordonthehills897@gmail.com or connect with us at our website, www.wordonthehills.com, where you'll find all our programs archived so you can listen to them anywhere and anytime. So thanks again for tuning in this week. We hope you'll join us for another program next week right here on Northumberland Radio 897 FM, truly local radio.